Lucy's dreaming.
Hello again, it's nice to hear you, nice. Welcome to episode 4 of the fourth anthology of the Lucid Dreaming Podcast, a space for conversation and reverie with moving image makers from around the globe, hosted by author and curator Pamela Cohn. We're flying to you with wings of dialogue in motion. So let's begin.
Hello, dreamers. Welcome to the Lucid Dreaming Podcast. I'm Pamela Cohn. In this episode, I have the pleasure of welcoming Brazilian producer, director, and scriptwriter, Beatriz Senier. Beatriz studied at the Municipal Conservatory of Music in her native São Paulo, followed by studies at the Centro Sperimentale de Cinema in Rome, as well as at the Faculty of Philosophy, Languages, and Human Sciences at the University of São Paulo. In 2002, Beatriz wrote and published Pejorive, the dialogue between two people that don't speak the same language, about her experience living with a Xavante indigenous tribe in Brazil, research that would be a profound touchstone for her future film work. As a scriptwriter, Beatriz has worked on feature film scripts for the cinema on projects by Walter Salles, Daniela Thomas, and Sergio Machado, and documentary television series for HBO and Canal Brasil, working with directors such as Eloisa Passos, Katia Lund, Maria Rocha, and Chau Vargas Pena. She is the founder of the film production house Miriage Filmes, the film distribution company Descoloniza Filmes, and is a council member of the publishing house Autonomia Literaria. In 2010, Beatriz realized her first feature called Bollywood Dream, the first Indian-Brazilian co-production. The film is an adventure comedy about three Brazilian actresses who decide to try their luck in the Bollywood film industry. Close to 10 years later, her film Los Silencios premiered at the 2018 Director's Fortnight at Cannes. The story takes place in the border town of La Isla de la Fantasia, a small island positioned at the river cut borders where the countries of Brazil, Colombia, and Peru converge. A masterful film and a significant departure from her first feature in almost every way, including the many long years it took to make, Los Silencios won many prizes and accolades around the world. I was honored to serve on the main jury at the Nuremberg International Human Rights Film Festival in Germany in the autumn of 2019, where we gave Los Silencios the top prize, amongst several other stellar film selections in the competition. But once you see the film, you never forget it. Featuring a cast of professional actors, non-actors, and real inhabitants of the island, Los Silencios tells the story of three refugees, Mother Amparo, played beautifully by Colombian actress Marleta Soto, and her two children Nuria and Fabio. They are escaping the civil war in Colombia, where Amparo's husband has gone missing and is presumed dead. The story proceeds to break linear timelines because slowly we realize that Fantasy Island is a liminal place, and not just geographically and politically. The story is subtle, mysterious, and deeply moving, with glorious cinematography by Sofia Ojoni. Unfortunately, I didn't get to meet Beatriz at Nuremberg since she had to leave early to go back to Brazil, but just a few weeks later in December, I invited her in the film to participate at an event at Still Point Spaces in Berlin as part of a day-long symposium on racism and ecology, which included a screening of the film and a panel discussion on migration, sovereignty, ecology, and cinema, with Beatriz joining us via video link from her home in São Paulo. As well as her artistic work, Beatriz is an engaged and outspoken activist. We'll talk more in this hour about what it's like living and working as an artist in Brazil these days. Even in her fiction films, Beatriz has a way of eliding stories about her protagonists with the daily timbre of a huge country in seemingly constant socio-political upheaval. After making a short fiction in 2019 called Olga's Family in São Paulo, Beatriz traveled to West Africa with her friend Toumani Konyate as he returns to his homeland, a small village in Mali. Between Us, a Secret, turned out to be a more or less traditional observational documentary, but as is usual with the films of Béatrice, there are other elements lurking in the farther corners of what we can see and hear. Cognaté comes from a long line of Gellis, traditional storytellers and conflict mediators to the royal family. Toumani's grandfather is ailing and wants to be certain that Toumani knows the full history of the ancestors and the locations that gave rise to the great Mandé Empire, where these storytellers, advisors to kings, and conflict intermediaries play a vital social role, fundamental for the maintenance of peace in Malinke society. The dynamic between the two directors, one white, female, and foreign, one black, male, and native, is fascinating and complex, and is in many ways at the heart of this story. Welcome to the Lucid Dreaming Podcast, Béatrice.
Thank you. It's great to be here with you again.
Yes, it's good to see you too, although we only see each other virtually, but nonetheless, it's okay. I kind of want to start with what your preoccupations are now. What is it like in Brazil? What is influencing you? Because I know you have a background in music, philosophy, languages, film, literature. It's all a mix and always has been way before you even made your first film as a director. And I know you have this passion for what is right and for what is wrong. And even in your most sort of innocuous seeming fiction films, I mean, I think of Olga's Family, and I think of this remark that's made in it about, oh, the Wi-Fi network is Lula. And everybody that has Lula, their password is free. You know, I mean, this is like, it made me laugh because I know you a little bit. And I know that whenever there's a way to say things here are really messed up. Yes. And even if there's a little hint of whatever is happening, the way in which you encounter it is always also too as a, I don't want to say arevist, but also like a stranger in a strange land. You know, you yourself as the filmmaker are not even very sure of what's going on. You can't comprehend anything. You're just there. You're there to get it, whatever it is. And this impresses me deeply in a way because it's a very brave thing to do. You know, many filmmakers are very obsessed in a way with whatever frame comes out of their imagination needs to be perfect and pristine, but yet you take such extraordinary chances. And I want to know a little bit about your background and about how you see the world from where you are. From where you are in Sao Paulo, what is happening there? What's happening in your mind right now?
Wow, it's great to be able to talk to all about all of this.
Yeah,
and it's great to meet somebody who has got deeply into my work. So it's like not therapy, but it's almost like that because we get to know more about ourselves.
That's
when
right.
when we talk about the films that comes out of us somehow. So it's that's really nice. So right now is a nightmare in Brazil. Mm. Bolsonaro is a genocide. We knew that before he got elected, but unfortunately we could not. It was a coup d'etat that happened in Brazil. I'm not sure if everybody is aware of what happened, but they took away our president, Dilma Rousseff, in 2016. Mm. Mm. Without her making any crime or without her making anything that was eligible for an impeach. So it was like a kind of a parliament coup d'etat. Mm-hmm. The only thing that she did is that she actually did not stop the investigations upon corruption. And of course, they discovered that there were a lot of oil in Brazil from the pre-salt Petrobras fields. And also what she tried to do is to low down the interest rates of the banks, which is something that here in Brazil is almost, when I made my first film, Bollywood Dream, my first feature film, I got some money from the bank that was pre-approved for me to buy a car. Mm-hmm. And the interest rate were 8.9% a month of that amount. So just to imagine the kind, when we need to do anything, to open a business, to get some cash for anything that we want to make, we have to pay almost 10% a month of interest, which means we get slaved by the bank system for forever. It took me almost 10 years, more than 10 years. I only pay this first loan that I got in 2010. And I got this loan in 2010, I managed to pay, and I got the loan in 2007. So it took me 3 years to pay. And I only managed to pay because Dilma Rousseff lowered down the interest rate of the public banks, making the whole market to try to lower a little bit more, like for 3% a month or 4% a month. Imagine that in the US, when you get some loan to open a company or to do something, you pay like 1% a year of interest rate. Here, mm-hmm. right now, that is, now it's up again. But when she tried to lower it down, it was like 4% a month, 3% a month. So I think what happened at the time, 2016, is that the market became furious with her and they managed to make a coup d'etat. This is my point of view. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, after this coup d'etat, there were elections again. I mean, Temer stayed there for a couple of years until there was election again. And then Lula, the former president, were in all the researchers and everything, he was first to get elected in first round with like a large distance from the second one, who was Bolsonaro. And then what happened? The judge of the first instance of law made some assumptions that his wife had gotten an apartment that she never bought, that they never bought, but she visited an apartment that they could have bought from a company that were making services for the government. So they tried to make something, like ambush them, but they never bought that apartment. But because they visited that apartment, that they didn't know one of the companies was Odebrecht, who were serving having contracts with the government, so they could not buy. When they realized that, they never bought the apartment, but because they visited, this small judge put him in jail. So it was very clear for everybody that that was an ambush, because putting him in jail and taking him his political rights made him get out of the competition, of the election game. Mm-hmm. And he had to stay in jail for over 1 year. For 580 days, he was in jail, unjustly, without any justice, without a fair judgment, until a hacker got inside the judge's cell phones through Telegram. And all the messages of the judge and the prosecutor and all of these who were combined came to publicly. So that happened a year ago. Mm-hmm. And right now, only yesterday, it was the Supreme Court judged the case. And Lula is finally completely free, because it was like clear that it was ambushed and there was no proof that he was involved in the building of that apartment or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And this small judge who is now living in the US. And when this happened, when the hacker got his message out to the press, The Intercept got the message, and Glenn Greenwald made he's a Pulitzer winner.
Yes, and runs the Intercept. Yes.
Yeah, he used to run the Intercept, and he lives in Brazil, so he follows very closely the. So that's to whom the hacker sent the messages, and he published it. Of course, he studied and published, made research and published. And only when that happened, this small judge went to the CIA in the US So, and then for 2 weeks, nobody could reach the judge. And we had the like pictures that he was like, it was like crazy, crazy, crazy. And this judge, he had also made with put in jail like all the owners of the main companies who were making Odebrecht and other main infrastructure companies who were making projects outside Brazil as well, like in Africa and other places, like infrastructure projects. And of course, there were corruption at the same time between all of those things, but he basically destroyed the economy of the country doing that, because all the main companies who were doing public huge buildings and roads and ports and all of those huge things had to be stopped because of that.
Mm-hmm.
And now this guy is a billionaire living in Miami. Just yesterday, he lost all his political powers in Brazil and all his judge powers in Brazil, because he was still receiving as a judge after doing all of that. So I think right now, for anybody who is serious, it's very clear that it was a coup d'etat who took Dilma Rousseff out of office in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
They saw that Lula was going to win the election, so they put him in jail for over a year so Bolsonaro could get elected.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, so we are living, and Bolsonaro is like somebody who has been in politics for over 30 years without doing anything, and he still is being shown as an outsider, you know, from politics.
Mm-hmm.
And he's somebody who graduated from the army and was expelled from the army because he tried to put a bomb in the army to raise the salaries of the soldiers. So even from the army, he got banished, you know. Like it's not. And he's involved with the militias of Rio de Janeiro, who asks money from the poor people for them to have electricity or basic water or like stuff like that. So, I mean, his connections and his family connection, his son's connections, they are connected with the Escritório do Crime, with the Office of Crime. That's the name of the office in Rio, which is a place where you hire killers. So they are personally, their family provides killer service. And his neighbor, in which the house has 37 guns and got caught by the police, the guns who killed Marielle Franco came from this neighbor of Bolsonaro who lives on the same like rich neighborhood.
Yeah.
Condominium. How do you say that?
Condominium. Yeah.
Condominium.
Not,
yes.
Not condom.
Not condom. Yeah. Yes, not condom. So they are involved with Marielle Franco's murder. And we really do hope that at some times they're going to get caught. And everybody who was involved in this murder got killed on this 2 years that Bolsonaro is in power.
Mm.
So we are living under threat. A lot of people that I know, we are in a list of people from the government who are seen as not terrorists, but like dangerous people which the government, the National Agency of Intelligence for Terrorism, has to keep an eye on. We are on this list.
So you are an artist. You are working in the arts and culture sector. You are making films that are, well, in the case of Los Silencios, we know. I mean, its debut at Cannes and Director's Fortnight, and this sort of way in which you represent these refugees, and the way in which you represent this whole entire world, which is mixed with what you just described, this terrorism, which is what this is what we can call it, because it is terrorism on behalf of the government, with helpless people that literally have nothing. And so I'm leading with this question only because I really think it's very important to set this socio-political setting in which an artist, a filmmaker, a painter, someone who is engaged in telling real stories, whether it's fictional, non-fictional, somewhere in between, we don't have to even distinguish that. But in every piece of work that you do, it's there. it's there. It's like a compulsory way, or your way perhaps as an artist, that you can express these things, that you can express this kind of free-floating anxiety and fear that can have very serious consequences. And I'm fascinated by the way in which you sort of tackle these things in it with a very, very light touch, in fact, with a very a nod to that, but yet you're very stubbornly ensconced in this way of story, of narrative, of this tactile way of saying, this is how we live, this is how we are living now. Whether it's in Brazil, whether it's in Colombia, whether it's in Peru, whether it's at the intersections of all of these borders, the way in which the socio-political position you have determines everything. And that's a very difficult thing to do without being didactic, without being sort of pounding, you know, your spectator. How is this, how do you think about with your team and with your early development stages of the stories you want to tell? What is at the forefront of your mind? Because I don't think actually, even though you are active and you talk about the sociopolitical atmosphere there, it's not at the forefront of things. It's in the background. It's something that's almost in that liminal space of the ghosts in your stories, the people that are in the sort of corners of what we can see and hear. And this, to me, somehow connotes a great trust in the spectator that they will innately understand what's at stake. I mean, even in the sense of these three actresses, these three Brazilian actresses that go to Bollywood, you know, and to see what that's all about. And on the surface, it's quite light and sort of comedic. But then when we listen to these women sort of start to observe, right? Mm-hmm. Being a foreigner in a strange land that still has this, hierarchy. Mm-hmm. There's a hierarchy always. There's the people in power. There's the people who serve those people in power, and there are those people who fight against the power, but in a very soft, we could say feminine, mm-hmm. sort of passive way. But nonetheless, for me, at least as a spectator, this makes it all the more powerful. This makes this soft power, and I want to get to your latest project with Tumani in a minute about this, but it makes this soft power actually really present. And I would love for you to talk about the discipline it takes to not like, you know, like shout to the heavens, like, I see so much wrong and I want to just shout to the heavens. But yet all of your films have this beautiful humanity, this beautiful subtlety that comes down to watching out for each other, that comes down to even in Olga's family, the way in which these neighbors, you know, everyone has a say, everyone has their point of view, and they're all, it's like a rainbow of different perspectives. And as a filmmaker, as a storyteller, how do you wrangle all of that? How do you sort of make that into a narrative that can encompass all of that?
Yeah, I think it's a lot of research. I nurture myself of research. Mm. Like when I was doing the Colombian film, Los Silencios, I interviewed over 80 Colombian families so I could have my imaginations with all these stories. And what I believe is that the political context is always there. And it, even though if you are not directly connected to that, it breaks into your family, it breaks into your history, it breaks into your path, because it's our collective history. So what I like to on films to watch and to make, because I think we also make what we watch as well. Mm-hmm. But what I like is to have this context as a background and to have moments where their stories have cracks and this political context come into whatever is happening in the family or in the story with the main characters through the television, through the radio, or through the story itself. So for example, on Volume Dream, they are three Brazilian actresses who are tired of like in Brazil having their bodies exposed in the media all the time, shaking their butts. And they go to India to try to make a more philosophical, existential films, spiritual films. And again, they are giving the bikinis to dance when they finally arrive in Bollywood. So for me as a feminist, I see that our bodies are seen like this, or we are always in this position everywhere in the world somehow. You can cross the world and still a lot of people are going to expect that from you as a woman. Mm. So I think this is something that connects the women all over the world somehow. This thing with the neighbors, with the help of each other between the neighbors, on August Families or on Los Silencios, for example, you see that very much, how much we depend on each other. How fragile is our life? And even though if we live alone, or if we want our autonomy, or we value our, I don't know, silence or freedom, how much we depend on each other to survive. So in August Family, I think this is very explicit somehow, because we have this 90 years old woman living alone with almost forgetting the fire on or the water on, and the neighbors think they are taking care of her, but she is actually taking care of the neighbors somehow. And I really do believe that in West society, we need to rescue this value of community. We need to be able to count with our neighbors and to count with one another, to make this network of sharing things, of knowledge, of protections, of love, or of all of that I miss in West society, to live in a tribe, to live in a community somehow. That's why I'm not living in São Paulo anymore. Now I'm living in the bushes. I'm living in the country for a while, in a sort of rural community. So I think these backgrounds always break into the film. Right now I'm having a lot of problem with my new project because so many things are happening at the same time politically. Mm-hmm. We have this crazy guy on the presidency who is just willing to kill as many people as possible. But every day there is a new scandal and there is a new thing that we could never think of in the Amazon. He's just doing the worst things and he's torturing us. When Dilma Rousseff was receiving the votes on the pitch, on the coup d'etat, on the impeachment, he voted for her to get impeached. And he said that he was giving his vote in the name of the guy who tortured her during the dictatorship.
Wow.
Ustra. He was like, in the name of Ustra, I vote for her to get out of office. Ustra is her torturer. So he's somebody who worships torture. And he's torturing all of us in a country. So I'm trying to put this in my next film project, but it's been so crazy and so hard because so many things, and I'm just feeling catatonic because I cannot believe somebody can be as cruel and sadic and like this. And there is still one in every three Brazilians who are still supporting him, which is crazy. And they are very much linked with this evangelical culture, and where the woman has to wear the dresses and have to keep the marriage and have to like all those things together. So yeah, I'm trying to tell a love story between three people in this very conservative and crazy country and sadic country that Brazil has not become. I think it has been always been there. Because we have this colonial past, which is this, never has been visited and has never been repaired. Like the social injustice from the colonial era, with the Black population, with the indigenous populations, with the woman, has never been repaired. We have never had, it's like Brazil is like, you know, the succession war in the US. Mm-hmm. it's like if the South has won, that's Brazil that we live in.
Mm-hmm.
Like the slaves' masters have won the conflict here. So we are in the hands of this elite who is very much supportive of slavery, all kinds mm-hmm. of slavery, yet. Of course, now cannot be explicit, but it's through other means, you know.
Right. Make
people still a slave of their work, of their small income and all of that. So I think this monster now is in our face in the form of the president, but has always been there in our elite and in our culture somehow.
Yeah.
And now we face this monster and see what we can do, you know.
Não posso crer, minha, que vocês estão vivos.
Tu abuelita ya te ha contado sobre los fantasmas de acá de la isla. Hay muchos y tienes que tener cuidado.
As an artist in the face of the monster, and in the U.S., of course, we just had the failed presidency of Donald Trump, which, yeah, he's like kind of a soulmate with Bolsonaro. And as I'm listening to you, we could sort of say thought for thought, word for word, this is very familiar territory. And South America, like the U.S., somehow has this richness in its ore and its oil and its natural resources. I mean, sort of, we can say very crudely, a land just waiting to be raped, you know, which it has been. But I want to sort of, you know, the lived experience of these indigenous groups in your country and on your continent. What I'm curious to really know is how that extrapolated itself going to Africa with your friend Tumani. This to me was a really fascinating film in so many ways. First of all, because it tends to be, it turned out to be sort of an observational documentary almost by default, because, you know, this way in which this cosmology works in a very tiny village in Mali is probably something very similar to what you've encountered. But in Africa, all you are is a white foreign woman. And it was so it was so delightful that almost the very first scene is you in the road filming with this black woman saying, "There's a white woman in the road." Like,
don't leave me alone here. I don't know what to do.
What is this white woman doing in the road, you know, with a camera? And the dialogues between you and Tumani were, for me at least, I mean, okay, I appreciated the history of the Jielis and the storytellers and all of that, but for me, the heart of the film is this relationship you have with Tumani, who is like schooling you in a way to say, you can be here with your camera. Certainly, I welcome you. We all welcome you. But there are distinctly things that you will not comprehend. You are not to ask stupid questions. You are not to put your camera in the faces of the elders. You are not to do that. I mean, like, he has this whole set of rules. And I was really fascinated by the fact that you kept this in the film. You kept this dialogue between the two of you, because clearly you are the professional artist. You are the professional filmmaker. This is why you're there. But nonetheless, you know, you are in a place that is not your place, and you're trying to understand. I'm very curious to know, because you've made a career almost of going into these places that are inexplicable to you. A Brazilian in India, a Brazilian in this place, a Brazilian in that place, even a Brazilian in Brazil. Sometimes this is like completely, what's happening? We don't know. You're disorientated. And this kind of disorientation, on behalf of the storyteller, on behalf of the director of the piece, is a real brave risk, in fact. And if you could talk a little bit about why it is you feel like you need to put yourself always in this kind of position, because I think it's a very personal thing for you, for Beatrice, but also informed by everything we've been talking about thus far. And for me, that relationship between you and Tumani, aside from the story that you're telling, is really sort of at the heart of it, because you talk about truth, you talk about falsity, you talk about, you know, between us, the secret is that the truth is actually the least useful thing in storytelling. And it is the falsity, it is the falseness that really is at the heart of the narrative. This to me is like, it's what people talk about all the time in our milieu of like documentary, nonfiction, fiction, hybrid, blah, 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 genre, you know. And it seems to me that consciously or unconsciously, you've made a dedication to this liminal space, to this nowhere place where people who can't figure out where in the hell they belong have to reside, and they have to reside there fully, completely, with all of their faculties, and somehow make sense of the stories that they're told, the ancestors, the history, you know, all of the socio-political ways in which we can function in our societies or not function. You know, there are many of us that don't function that well. But we have to fake it till we make it, as they say, you know? And I find this is something very fascinating for me in your work in particular. And in this film, watching you grapple with all of this for me was the real heart of the story. Can you talk a little bit about your experience there? And
so great to hear you.
Yeah. And how you, you know, because I kind of know you and I know your earlier work and we've talked a little bit, and I'm thinking, wow, you must have struggled greatly. You must have struggled really, really a lot with all of these things that I'm sort of, you know, bringing up right now. So yeah, if you could talk about that, that would be great. I think
probably one of the most difficult films I've made is this last one.
Yeah.
I think there is something that you capture, is that I have always the feeling that I'm kind of an alien, you know, like everywhere I am or anything that is happening, I'm most of the time watching, and then I'm just like, oh my God, is this really happening? There is kind of a absurd, not absurd, but at the same time, a curiosity about everything
surreal,
that is happening.
Yeah.
Surreal thing. Like, is this a dream? Yeah. No, it's life. It's a dream. No, this is really life. I woke up and I'm here, you know, like it's not like a dream. Okay. So it's kind of existential crisis of where do we belong, or what do we, like in India, in the first film, something that they asked me a lot when I lived there was, what do you belong to? And this is a question that I keep bringing with me, what, to whom I belong or to where I belong. I truly think it's to the whole humankind. I see the distinctions between the cultures, but I see so much similarities between the humans being and our necessities that are much higher than our distinctions somehow, even though I value very much the distinctions. And so I think I have an existential crisis, which makes me all the time be trying to to understand us as a humanity. They say like it's like a onion that you have to keep. If you peel the onion, it's like our differences, cultural distance, you know, like race distances or gender thing, distance. But when you get into the heart of the onion, we are all pretty much the same. And I like to question myself, who am I outside my cultural background or my cultural building, like my family background, my neighborhood background, my country background, my continent background, or like, who am I like outside all of this? Mm. Who am actually I, or something like that, or us? So I think that's why I kind of put myself into the situations where I can test myself or see the characters into situations that are outside my, all these boxes that we grow thinking that this is obvious and it's not obvious in another culture. So I try to break these little boxes somehow, cultural boxes that we grow on. And then on this film particularly, it's amazing because I was really, I mean, Tumani asked me to go there in a week. I was very interested in this culture of the griots and jalis, who are storytellers, but also conflict mediators. And they are the masters of the world, and they can make the people come to peace or come to war because they have this power of insurgency and of. So I was very interested in this culture. And then Tumani said, okay, next week, my grandfather asked me to go there to receive a piece of a story. And I know that you are all the time talking about that. And I was filming his plays and his shows, his gigs. Would you like to come? And I was like, oh my God, in 1 week. Yeah, okay, let's see what I can do. And let's borrow my mother's credit card and let's ask my Indian friend some money, like producer. And then he sent me some money from the US and let's see what we can do. And in 1 week we were there. So it was a film without any preparation. I mean, only, okay, I was filming him for over 3 years. And I was studying this for over, I don't know, 5-6 years. So I had this mental preparation, but no practical preparations to go there. And of course we had no money. So I was doing the camera and the sound, we hired somebody and like all these kind of things. And then when I got there, there was this huge assembly of all of them together that they have not met for over 20 years because when Thomas Sankara was killed, this is something that I discovered very, just like a couple of weeks ago, they have to leave the country because they were involved with the government of Thomas Sankara, which were one of the best presidents of Burkina Faso who made the Burkina Revolution. And they have all to fly away because since they were so respected by the culture, by the country, by the people, they could make the people go against the new government who made the coup d'etat. So it was the first time they were meeting after 20 years, 27 years or something like that, 26 years, that all the jailers were meeting again after this event of the killing of Thomas Sankara. So there was this big assembly and I was not understanding anything they were saying. And then there was no story of the grandfather decided that he was not going to tell the story anymore because somebody didn't come for this big assembly. And then I was there with Tumani and said, like, okay, let's ask about the, you know, like the story of Somjata and this guy that I'm hearing and like, let's make these questions. And then I proposed for him, like, let's direct this film together because I cannot, I'm a total foreigner here. I mean, I grasp very little of what they are saying in Bambara. I don't understand anything. So we started to make this trip together and to put the pieces together. And we didn't realize that he was passing through an initiation process, that he was on his last phase of the jelly initiation, and that at the end they have actually chosen him to be the counselor of the next president of Burkina.
So he truly didn't know that that was in store for him, that he would be passed the baton and told that he is the new leader. Yeah, it was
new counselor.
The new counselor. Yeah, it was very moving. It was very moving.
We didn't have an idea. We thought it was going to be like a storytelling night. And then they were actually preparing him through this trip and passing through all these like sacred places and like And of course, he was extremely touched because he was like, he's an actor and he played, you know, like he's been for over 20 years, not most of his life, but for over 25 years out of the country. And then he received his huge duty to serve the country as a storyteller and conflict mediator. And then he was like, oh my God, maybe they chose me because I made the questions to them that you asked me to do for the documentary, you know, like maybe it's a mistake. And I was like, it's not a mistake. Come on, they know everything, you know. They are all the time like playing these magical things. They know you are the one to be chosen, you know. So it was a big existential crisis for him also to receive that le bâton de la parole, the word stick. And something that I didn't realize until later, that is not in the film, that I'm just talking between us now, 6 months later, there is another coup d'etat, and the guy who killed Thomas Sankara flew out of the country.
Oh.
So 6 months later that all the storytellers got together, they somehow managed to take the guy out of the country. So I don't know if there is a straight link between those events. That's why I didn't put on the film or anything like that, but they do have some power somehow as masters of the world and somebody who can like somehow integrate the country and as storytellers.
Well, fascinatingly, I mean, you know, in the film, there's a lot that's mentioned about the role of the storyteller, and that in most of the rest of the world, this notion of the traditional storyteller is, I don't know, something of the past. It's not something that's even necessarily respected so much. In we could say almost any culture, except these more ancient ones where the storyteller is, you know, the one who keeps those sacred myths. And I really appreciated the way in which Toumani spoke to you about the fact that these are myths, you know, the history and the mythos are one and the same. And I think for people who want to make cinema, as you do, no matter how high the blockage is or the fences around the way in which we can do that, stems from this way in which we can be malleable about what's important to say, not the truth or the falsity of what is said, but the way in which the role of the storyteller, the social function of the storyteller, is really, really powerful, as you've just attested, as you just described. They can make massive changes. And again, you know, there were so many interesting reverberations between that and Los Silencios, in a sense, because this, the old man says, I continue telling stories even though no one listens. No one listens anymore. And a child asks him, well, why do you continue to tell these stories if no one listens? And he says, I continue to storytell so the world doesn't change me. You know, it's not about changing the world. It's about staying true to the way in which a storyteller like you, like all of the people we speak to who move into foreign lands where they don't belong, distinctly don't belong, but nonetheless, their eyes and ears are open. They're receiving, they're receptive, you know? And this piece was so fascinating to me because despite your receptiveness, despite your choice to go, knowing that you will be, maybe you didn't even realize how disorientated you will be, but this separateness, this disorientation, I mean, what does that give you as a film director? What does that give you that as a storyteller? What does that, what instincts in you that are maybe dormant in your own environment where you kind of know, okay, this is the lay of the land. I know how things work. This makes sense. This doesn't make sense, but it's all familiar somehow. But that way in which you purposefully, you know, implant yourself, I'm curious to know if you can talk a little bit about what that gives you as a director, you know, this, because you are in a sense, I felt you were relying on him, but I also felt your fight against relying on him completely. You know, it's like, I have a camera in my hand. This is normal for me. I'm documenting, I'm listening, I'm looking, I'm being told there are rules here of how much I can do. But nonetheless, you take that chance. And I know there are filmmakers who are working or wannabe filmmakers who are working who would have an extremely hard time being in that kind of position, because it's a way in which you have to trust implicitly in something you don't understand. And as an artist, I feel in a sense, this is really the impetus of an artist, but so many people really step away, shy away from this opportunity, and you don't.
Yeah.
Why I is think, that? Yeah, what is it? What is it in you that refuses to sort of be in this comfortable place where it's like, okay, I know what's going on. I can document this. This makes sense to me.
Yeah. And most of the time I have no idea, you know, like I'm, especially on this one, I'm just like, is that complete trust? I have this feeling that the films already exist.
Mm.
He's going to show out him or her, whatever, eat the film. It's going to show itself to us. And we just have to be there ready to record, you know?
Mm.
So I have this complete trust in this force of film, of nature. It's like a dance, you know? Like when you are thinking too much, you cannot dance very well. You have to let it go, your mind, so you can follow the dance. You can follow the movement. You can actually grasp this light that connects all of us. So, of course, I have a lot of concepts in my mind. I have a whole formation. I have a study. I have all of this. But when I'm filming, I put everything aside and I'm just there with the people. And for me, it's magical, it's divine to have the opportunity to be there with the people, to actually share the same moment and to share this breathing and whatever is happening. So I really do try to put apart all my rational thinking. And mm-hmm. then I rescue there on the editing room. Then I rescue that, this rational thoughts and all of this on the other parts of when I'm making a film, in the research, sometimes in the script,
mm-hmm.
but mostly at the editing room. Because when I'm there, it's like a dance, you know, you have to actually really connect. It's like when you are in a dancing room and you connect your eyes with somebody, it's like, what is happening? You don't know what is happening. You don't know what is going to happen. You have no idea. But either you follow that or you just reject that. That's okay. But you have to, it's something, you know, that is out of our control. And I think most of the time, life is out of our control. I mean, it's like a wave that you catch the wave or you don't catch the wave, but it's not something that you can control. I don't know, so I like to put my place in these places where even though I know a lot, I forget everything that I know, so I can learn something that is new. That I can really, with humility, and especially with these cultures who are ancient and who are just much older than me or than the Western culture, than everything that we have been taught in school or, you know, on the media and all of that. I really try to approach those subjects and peoples or even a wound like Los Silencios, that I approach this open wound from the Colombian war with much respect, you know, like with much humility. Humility, you say?
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. With because I know I have a power with the camera to show a part of something. And we have to approach the things that we are showing or getting in touch with much respect. But yeah, most of the time I really like, I completely trust the universe that the film is going to appear. And there I am with the camera ready to record it.
Yeah, it's
it is a mystical thought, magical thought. I don't know.
In a way it is, but I mean, your films do have that magical element is there. It's just kind of sometimes even on the periphery, you know, it's sort of on the edges of things, you know, in a sense of, again, as the film shows, like passing the stick, you know, it's like the person with the camera, the perception is you have the stick, but you're also passing it. You know, there is this, sharing, you know, of the responsibility of making sure, right, that the story is told in the way it needs to be told. And the truth or falsity of it is not the point. it is that shared experience. It is the circle, you know, around the fire. There is, you know, as I see in all of your films, the way in which we share those deepest, you know, human yearnings. So,
and there are some things that we will never understand.
No.
And that's okay.
Yeah.
I mean, we as white people,
yeah,
we have this kind of, I don't know, of willingness to understand everything, to write about everything, to like, you know, like really like understand everything. And there's some things that we'll never understand. Like, I don't know, death and birth and like beginning of the universe of life, you know, like we'll never actually understand, you know, exactly anything.
No. But I, again, I, exactly. But I appreciate this humility in the way you approach things. I mean, again, even in your fiction work, even with a very, very carefully scripted, commissioned, with professional actors, you know, but still, you know, you manage to sort of put that seed of doubt, you know, into how we can communicate with one another in ways that aren't necessarily logical or, you know, philosophical even. And I think in cinema, particularly, this kind of mystery, this kind of inexplicable way we can relate to one another can express itself so beautifully. And I so look forward to the works you're going to make, you know, because I feel like, in a sense, this is each thing is an adventure. Each thing is a leap, if you will, a leap of faith. Yeah. And I really deeply appreciate that.
Yeah. I think even when you are, I don't know, you live with somebody for 50 years or 100 years, you still don't know everything, you know, still is a mystery.
Yeah.
And I think instead of being afraid of the mystery that we are, everybody is, and that we all are, and that the nature is, we actually should, I don't know, be in love with mystery and just get into it somehow.
Yeah.
So, I'm looking very forward to shoot again after COVID gives a break to us.
Soon.
Here in Brazil,
I know.
We maybe one more year, but we will be there. I'm sure we will be there.
Thank you, Beatriz. It was so lovely to talk to you again.
So nice.
Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us here.
That's all for this episode, our listeners. We will return next week with a conversation with Louis Henderson. Lucid Dreaming is a production of Lono Studio, hosted by Pamela Cohn. Do subscribe, leave us a review, recommend us to friends. Goodbye, dreamers. Hi folks, Lucid Dreaming is now on Patreon. You can support us to keep our episodes ad-free and keep us rolling in the studio. We'd like to give a shout out to our first supporter, Andrea Kuhn. You can support us at different rates at patreon.com/lucid dreaming podcast and get some cool stickers and maybe a tote bag.